I need you to knock some sense into me. I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I don't know.
I enjoy listening to you. I don't always agree with everything.
All right. Enough of this persiflage.
So, you want my question?
I'm certainly not going to get myself in trouble by telling you what to do.
That makes great sense. Gosh, that's good.
That I overwhelm you with words and wisdom?
I've got 7 kids. I feel like I could call you every day.
What? Wait, you're telling me I'm wrong?
Yes, I am, Dr. Ray.
You just need to tune in to Dr. Ray, honey. He's got all the answers.
Am I right or am I right?
Probably.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
I looked up persiflage, use it a lot, and it means a kind of a frivolous banter. Just kind of a jock. Let me give you the actual definition. Light bantering talk or writing. A frivolous or flippant style of treating a subject. Persiflage. Kind of like badinage. Where's badinage? Hold on a second. Badinage is the same kind of thing. Hold on. Let's see what it means here. Badinage. It is light, playful banter. Yeah, or raillery. Huh? You don't hear that one very often. R-A-I-L-L-E-R. Raillery. To banter with or to tease someone playfully. So, why? I've always been fascinated by vocabulary. The English vocabulary is huge. I forget how many hundreds of thousands of words, and it's huge. And I remember reading the dictionary. Yeah, this is basically the height of nerddom that I had achieved in college. No wonder I couldn't get a date. I read the dictionary. I went all the way up to S before I finally got bored with the plot. A lot of characters. Definitely a lot of characters. And certainly a lot of synonyms. But the plot just went nowhere. And I really didn't know how it was going to end. Under maybe zygote would be the way it would end. I don't know. Did I remember what I read? No. To remember vocabulary, you got to use it. You got to use it. And most of the time. And why would you? Who's going to say persiflage? I want people to say persiflage are people trying to show off. Sorry. All right. This is Look Back Friday. Take calls from previous shows. Got a call from Anonymous, Janet, Laura, and Joe from previous shows. Going back a couple of months. And then I'm going to talk more about the call. Usually there's something within the call that spurs a thought that I'd love to interject, but I can't. Because we're trajectoring in a different direction. I don't think trajectoring is even a word, but it's a neologism. Made up word. Kind of like unoffendability is a neologism. So we'll get to those in a second. But one of the things as I get older that I recognize is that I have a very, very limited view of existence. Now, what do I mean by that? In the vast majority of human history, and even some human societies today, they lived radically differently than I live in terms of comforts, in terms of safety, in terms of opportunities, in terms of material gifts, radically. And for the most part, for the 99.999% of human history, they lived the same. This was sent to me in the year 2000. So it says 100 years ago. And I used to be fascinated talking to my grandparents and even my mom and dad about what it was like growing up when they did. This is from a book called When My Grandmother Was a Child. In 1900, now we're not talking the Mesozoic era here. We're talking 125 years ago. We're talking basically two lifetimes ago. That's it. In the U.S., the average life expectancy was 47. People died a lot from illnesses because we didn't have antibiotics. 14% of the homes in the U.S. had a bathtub. Think about that next time you're taking a hot shower. 8% of the homes had a telephone. 8%. So you couldn't contact, 92% of you couldn't contact anybody. Now, contact anybody in the world in a moment's notice. 8%. In the U.S., there were 8,000 cars. There's now several hundred million. 8,000 cars. 144 miles of paved roads in all of the U.S. The Romans had much longer paved roads than we did. Tallest structure in the world is the Eiffel Tower. I think the Eiffel Tower is about 700 feet. Average wage in the U.S. in 1900, 22 cents, 22 cents an hour. Average salary for the, well, salary or work wages, $200 to $400 a year. An accountant could expect to earn $2,000. A dentist, $2,500. A vet, now this goes to show you how important animals were then, between $1,500 and $4,000 a year, and a mechanical engineer about $5,000 a year. So 95% of all births in the U.S. took place at home. That's why the infant mortality was so high. I had some of my children were born and they were in intensive care. My son was in intensive care for a month. He would have died. My daughter, she got pneumonia when she was 4 months old. We had to put her underneath an oxygen tent and she survived it, but she probably would have died. My son, he was born with a cleft lip and palate. They would have cast him out. He couldn't have talked. Wouldn't have been able to eat because it would go straight up into his nasal cavity. Probably he would have been killed deliberately, depending upon where he was born. 90% of all U.S. physicians had no college education. Most women wash their hair once a month. Imagine how oily it would get. And they used borax or egg yolks for shampoo. Now, talk about immigration controversy. Canada, in 1900, passed a law prohibiting poor people, I don't know how they define poor people, from entering the country for any reason as travelers or immigrants. Five leading causes of death. Now, in the U.S., the leading cause of death right now is heart, stroke, cancer. Those are the three. Then, pneumonia and influenza. Number two, tuberculosis. Number three, diarrhea. Then number four was heart disease. Five was stroke. Las Vegas. Population in 1900 was 30 people. It was inhabited by a handful of ranchers and their families. Plutonium, which is involved with nuclear fuel, insulin, and antibiotics hadn't been yet discovered. So if you got diabetes, you died because your body consumed itself. My son is a type 1 diabetic. 1 year at Thanksgiving, we did the old go around the table and say what you're grateful for, and everybody was saying family, and everybody was pointing out various social, emotional aspects of their existence, and Andrew just simply said insulin. Because he knew. He would have been dead. 1 in 10 U.S. adults couldn't read or write, and only 6% of all Americans graduated from high school. My grandfather had a third grade education, and my grandmother had a sixth grade on my dad's side. Marijuana, heroin, and morphine were all available over the counter at corner drugstores. Coca-Cola contained cocaine instead of caffeine. And this is the big one. And again, this could be a conservative estimate because of reporting difficulties. there were about 230 reported murders in the U.S. annually. Compared to today, what is it, about 25,000? What a difference a century makes, huh? All right, when we come back, we will get to those previous calls here on Look Back Friday.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
When one has real love for another, not mere emotional attachment, that one moves out of the isolation of his own existence to know the other's thoughts, emotions, sufferings, and even beyond this, to know the other's reality. The illusion, though, is that loving is a natural capacity, easily and automatically acquired. This is an illusion reinforced by the popular concept of falling in love, a term implying a complete lack of volition. Fundamentally, though, the notion of love's facility is not true, for the whole process of coming out of ourselves is not easy or automatic. Now, especially, in our climatically controlled, screen-dominated worlds, we exist within our own spaces, within our own minds, and those who are the most difficult to see become the most difficult to love. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Dr. Ray Guarendi here, program Doctors In. In my most recent book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody, I said there were certain terms you have to watch in your language. And I think this is probably why I selected this call for Look Back Friday. One of those phrases is emotionally abusive. That's a very broad umbrella term. And in many respects, we decide how emotionally abusive something is going to be toward us. But we have an anonymous female from Texas, and she's struggling. She wants to leave what she considers an emotionally abusive relationship.
I know that toxic and narcissistic are, I heard you yesterday, I know there are trendy words that can dismiss, I guess, what I'm trying to say, but I listened to Dr. Ramani, and a lot of the things she was saying applied to my husband. And I thought, well, I'm not going to diagnose him. It's not like I'm not doing that. But I do see, like, I was able to see through that I am, how do I say it? That there's some things that are definitely not okay. And in the beginning, if I disagreed with my husband, he would not, like, hit me, but put my, like, restrain me. And he'd get really angry the more I disagreed with him. And I try to say, well, let's just disagree. And, like, and that doesn't affect, like, our stability of our marriage. Like, we can coexist and, like, have disagreements. Maybe later we will agree. But it's like he couldn't live with not agreeing. But then if I gave it to him, I'm not being genuine. Like, so it got to the point where I went to therapy and I realized, okay, or I learned better how to communicate. But now it's to the point where we'll get to a situation where if he disagrees with me, he'll name call me really bad names. And I don't think that that's like, I think that is the problem, not that we disagree, because I feel like any disagreement, someone can, like, can still live through, I guess, like, still respect each other.
Are you still seeing your therapist?
I stopped. But with, I did talk to a priest. He knew a little bit more of us, like, prior to getting married, and he said that wasn't okay, a lot of the things that he was doing. And
especially if it's getting physical.
In the beginning of our marriage, yes, not like hitting me across the face, but like manhandling me for like grabbing my arm to like.
Has that stopped?
That has stopped, but that's because now I don't say anything, I disengage, and I don't talk back to him at all. But he wants me to agree with him, and he will like corner me. And
how long
like,
have you been married, ma'am? Ma'am, how long have you been married?
3 years. Well, 4 years. I don't.
Do you remember. Have children?
Yes.
It says here on the note that you want to leave your husband.
Yeah, because even when we were okay for a little bit, I just like it doesn't
does
matter
he,
if I do
does
everything.
Does he know?
Perfect.
Does he know you want to leave him?
No, I haven't told him that yet.
What
I've actually just tried to like.
How do you think
like,
he'll react?
Parents. I don't know. I know he's told
are
me
you,
that.
Are you dead set on leaving him for sure? There's nothing he can say or do or promise that.
I don't think he will change, because I did everything. Like I am like okay. I don't talk back to him. I got to the point because at first I did get frustrated.
Okay.
And I would yell back.
You're
at him,
describing.
But now
you're describing a very complex. Marital situation, and I know there's a massive amount of history and details here that wouldn't lend themselves well to me doing therapy over the phone. Let me just give you a couple of thoughts. One child or two?
Two.
So you understand that if you leave, chances are he'll want to get 50-50. And so you won't have any control over how he raises those children when they're with him. You understand that?
He's a good dad. Yeah, and he's a good dad. He's nice to them. He'll like...
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. The only...
Now, I think that a lot of it's going to come down to, for you to decide, if he is difficult to live with, disrespectful, calls names... For you to decide, is this something that is worth me leaving the marriage, destroying this, not just destroying, splitting the family? Or is this something that maybe I can give him some options that he
I've
will...
I've given him options before. I've told him if he goes to therapy, anger management.
He won't go.
He
won't go. All right. So I can't tell you what to do here. I don't know how this views...
When he's mad...
How this sits with your Catholic faith, I don't know. If you leave, are you saying, well, too bad, so sad, this marriage is over, I'll remarry.
Yeah, I don't think like that. I just know, like, to me, I don't care to remarry. Like, I know what the faith teaches. Like, I just don't think I'm doing him well. I think, like, I'm allowing him to do that, and he's doing it in front of the kids at times. So... That's where I'm like,
okay.
I don't know.
So my dear, what are you asking me?
Yeah, I guess I just, like, how do I discern that?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to come down to how much you allow his conduct to affect you. In other words, he can call names, but those names don't have to impact you the way they are. You could look at him like that's a serious problem on his part. You can say any crappy thing you want to say to me. I don't have to absorb it. You could do that.
That's how I've been living. The thing is, like, when he gets mad, and, like, I just sit there, and he's yelling at me, calling me horrible names, allowing my kids to see that.
Why don't you go talk to a priest again and get some sorting through of this? Because I really can't tell you what to do here or how to do it, because this is a 5-6 minute radio call. And I know that you'd like an answer But I think the thing that's going to happen is you're going to have to see how he reacts, because you've never told him, I'm thinking of leaving this marriage. So it'll be interesting to see what he says. He may say, good, go, be glad to get rid of you. Or he may be shaken and say, I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose the kids. So I don't want to become a part-time dad. So what do I need to do at this point? My dear, that's okay. Just some thoughts for you. I wish I could give you more. If you took 100 people and listened to how she described her marriage and her husband, I would suspect about 96 of them would say, get out of there. Get out of there. You don't have to be treated like that. It is not okay. Especially the physical part. Now, the physical part, absolutely. There's no way she needs to be in a place where she can be physically abused. But if it's just his raw ugliness, they would say that. And that would bring into question, for them, the church's teaching on divorce and remarriage, because very few people who are Catholic and who get a divorce and say, yeah, I know divorce is wrong and we shouldn't be doing it, very few of them stay single. They will remarry civilly. They will start dating. It's just the way it is. It's a church teaching that comes straight from Christ, like it or not, and very few people follow it. So, I mean, after the divorce, that is. A lot of people persevere in really ugly marriages because of the church's teaching, and God bless their heroic efforts. I don't know why he is this way toward her. My guess would be, and I don't know him at all, I'm speculating, my guess would be that he's an enormously insecure guy. She keeps insisting he has to be agreed with. You've got to celebrate my opinion, the way I see things. And don't patronize me by shutting up, because I know you're just disagreeing silently. Yeah, to be that angry and upset over things that she doesn't agree with really indicates a lot of insecurity. A lot. Now, that said, now this is going to come as, it's going to sound like relational heresy to some of you. Keeping in mind, we've heard her description of the situation, and I have no reason to believe it's not that way. However, I've had enough experience in marital situations that much of what is described is oftentimes very subjectively inclined. And I'm not saying he's a wonderful guy. But I wouldn't be totally shocked if he came into my office and he said, yeah, we used to see how she talks to me. Or used to see what she says to me. Now, again, can't know that, but that's been my experience. So I always recognize that I am hearing a perspective. And the degree that it reflects reality varies. Now, she was pretty consistent. She said he's a good dad. The first thing I thought was, well, how can you be a good dad if you're a bad husband? And then she said he does this in front of the kids. That's not a good dad. Whether it means he plays with them or he's sweet with them. But if, in fact, this is how he treats a relationship that is close, I would wonder how he would treat a 14-year-old who's difficult. Yeah, right now the kids are little. Of course. They're no threat. What, one and a 2-year-old or one and a 3-year-old? Who knows? They've only been married 3 years. Or maybe they lived together prior to that, and they had kids prior to marriage. Don't know. There's just a whole lot of unknowns there. But you can't be a good dad if you're a nasty husband. That's really hard. It doesn't come down to how you treat the kids. It comes down to how you treat their mother. I've noticed, I always head for the refrigerator. I walk into the room and I head to the refrigerator. I just open it up. It, like, I'm hoping that something new to eat will be there. Even if I just went to the refrigerator an hour ago, you know? I've noticed that. So, what else do I want to know? You ever notice how you don't hear too many father-in-law jokes? A lot of mother-in-law jokes, no father-in-law jokes. There are grains of truth to every cliche or stereotype. Look back Friday here with my producer man, Andrew Krucek, who edits these calls. And we try to find them in a particularly consistent length, 4 to 6 minutes. So that one was a shade over the 6 minute mark. There was so much to comment on there, and I can continue to comment on it, but I'm going to go to another call. Joe from New York called. His grandson is struggling. We'll find out what his grandson's struggling with. And Joe's question is, okie dokie, how much do I enter in and support?
I have a 23-year-old grandson who's been a little bit of a problem since he was born, I guess. But, you know, had struggled through high school, made it finally, went into a community college, and never made that happen, just spent a lot of money. And he has not really found his way to being a good employee. I mean, he's had many jobs that there's always an excuse as to why they let him go or they've been unfair. You know, he's gotten himself financially in trouble. I've helped him out. His father's helped him out. He bounces from job to job. And I don't know. I told him, I said, you know, number one, you need to be honest. You need to be honest with people and yourself. And you need to find out what you're doing or not doing that people let you go from a certain position. And I think he's looking now. He just the other day got let go and had an excuse as to why. And I think he's looking for me to try to help him out financially until he can find another job, which I've done in the past. I've bailed him out of credit cards and student loans. His father's done the same thing. So I'm just at a loss how to help this kid.
Well, you said some key things here, Joe. You said this has been a long, long-standing social problem, maybe going back because of his temperament or because of the way he was raised, that he's just not real responsible. Because of that, he tends to blame others, and he can't hold on to jobs because his frustration tolerance is very low. And you've talked with him. You've attempted to get him to think a little more clearly about all this, and it doesn't seem to be doing anything. So you help him out. You figure, okay, when he messes up, I'll prop him up until the next job. So here's the question, Joe. When are you going to decide no more propping up?
I think I decided that. he's called me. I've given him advice. I told him if you're out of work, you know, there's a lot of jobs out there. You know, you ought to be looking. And if you can't find one, go collect unemployment.
Where's he living?
I don't know how to do that.
Where's he living, Joe?
he's got his own apartment. You know, he has a new car that he leases. As far as I know, those are probably the only two real expenses that he has, other than food and gas.
He must be working enough, or we're hoping it's legitimate. He's working enough to pay those bills. Those are not small bills. So where's he getting money?
So far, he's worked. He worked for me for a little while, and I let him go because he wasn't doing the job. And I told him, you need to grow up and get a job with somebody else and show that you're responsible.
Here's a question, Joe.
And,
when he comes to you and he says, Grandpa, I ran out of money and I don't have money to pay my rent. And now all of a sudden the bank is sending me notices they're going to repossess my car. What are you going to do, Joe?
Good question. That's my struggle, Doctor. That's my struggle. As to, I'm one to try to help out everybody to a certain extent. especially those who help themselves.
Well, there's the key.
I don't know.
There's the key. I guess, Joe, you can do that, but I don't know if there'll be any end to it. You have to decide if and when the end will come regarding your support and whether you're helping him out by continuing to do this. There's a lot of this now out there. I think a lot of ingredients come into the picture. Of course, we've, in many respects, become a spoiled society. We want what we want. And in many respects, there are people willing to do what Joe did, which is to bail this person out. But there's a scripture verse that always echoes in my mind when St. Paul says, "Let him who does not work not eat." Now, see, in our culture, we would never say something like that. That just sounds so harsh, because there are obviously people who can't work, and that's true. But here's a able-bodied 23-year-old, for whatever the reason, doesn't like rules and limits, doesn't like conditions for employment. He can't hold a job. Typically, what's going to happen, and my guess would be this is the trajectory of all this, at some point, he's going to come to his grandpa with a very serious situation. I'm going to be on the street. They're going to take my car. I am in trouble. I got a girl pregnant. Whatever it is going to be real serious. Or being suicidal in his thinking. That's always one that really shakes people up. So then what's Joe going to do? You know, up to this point, he's bailed him out for whatever expenses. But if this kid keeps living this way, the chances are, now not always, some people do straighten up, but the chances are he's going to become more serious in his irresponsibility. And then Joe's going to be cornered. I always ask the question, why? What is it that is driving a parent or a grandparent to continue to do this to an irresponsible kid, one who's capable but just not doing it? Now, one might say, yeah, but he had a rough upbringing, you know, he wasn't really taught. Okay, I got that. So we know some of the factors in to why he is the way he is today, but this is today. If he doesn't pull himself together, he's going to continuously slide downward. And then. So I don't think Joe is really done with this young man, because I think the young man's going to come to him and really know how to pull on his grandpa's heartstrings with serious stuff. Seems to be the case. A long, long, long history of this. And the longer the history, the more likely that this kind of financial bailing out is not going to work at all. It only makes it worse. And I think that seems to be the critical question that needs to be answered. Am I making it worse? Am I actually raising the chances of bad stuff happening because I am prolonging this kind of lifestyle? Improving your mind by the minute. Used to be by the sentence, but as I get a little bit older there, I have to say a few more words to raise your IQ. Used to be able to do it within probably 6 or 8 words. But we have done some studies, and chronic listeners to this program over the course of a year, chronic is, say, twice a week. It pretty much raises your IQ about 12 points. And if you stop listening, there is some slippage. You'll drop 6-8 points, but you'll still have the residual IQ raising. That can happen. All right, let's see who we're going to go to next on this Look Back Friday. Janet from North Carolina is reiterating what pretty much is now common understanding in our culture, and especially heavily pushed by the experts, which is early childhood shaped her.
I grew up in a home where my dad was an alcoholic, and there was a lot of abuse, a lot of verbal abuse, and, you know, physical altercations between my parents. My mom was a devout Catholic, and my dad always promised to go to church, and I think he went a week or two, and then that went by the wayside, and then he's just rejected the faith and rejected God and criticized her for going to church and spending her time there. And so it was, you know, tumultuous for my brother and I growing up, and then even in our adult years, even when we're on our own, because the two of them were still together, to the point where I'm from Canada. I met my husband through Catholic Mass, actually. So I moved down to the States, and I actually ended up calling the police from here to my parents' home in Canada after my dad left yet another threatening message, you know, drunk message on our answering machine threatening my mother. And I had enough, and I called the police back up there in Canada. They took him away, and he couldn't go home. He had to get his own place. It was just shocking to everybody, of course, and they separated for 6 months. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, I guess he had to have heart surgery, and he did okay with that, but my mom felt sorry for him and took him back to the house. And over the years, I've had conversations with her about leaving, of course, and I just wanted to comment that so many times I wish, as a child, and a little child, an older child, a teenager, I wished that she would have left. I wished that I didn't have to endure that situation. I wished that I didn't have to listen to the things I heard and see the things that I saw. And I wished someone would have taken us away. I wish that she would have been on her own. We could have had a peaceful life. Hopefully she could have peace. And the issue still for me is that clearly I have these wounds, and they follow you into adulthood. They shape your life. They shape your personality. I know I have negative, you know, it's affected me negatively, which has then transferred, you know, into my marriage and the way I treat my husband or see my husband sometimes, or the things I do or say, or my personality, because of all that, of that situation and all the anger and all the abuse and everything. And I struggle because here I am 51 years old, and my parents are still together. My dad, now after I made that phone call and they had to separate, the one good thing that happened is that he quit drinking. So he's been sober for about 10 years now, 9 years or 10 years, but he still remains to be
why do you think your mom stayed with him?
I honestly think that she didn't get the right advice at times from priests who had, you know, really solely influenced her to stay because of the Catholic marriage, because I got married in Catholic Church, even though she had every right to, she had every right to leave because of the way he was and because of the abuse that was taking place. And I think she always, you know, she always hoped that he would change. She always, you know, all of us, and we spent decades praying for a change of heart and mind for him. But he just seems to get more and more hardened. Even when he had his leg amputated, he's a type 2 diabetic, had his leg amputated a couple years ago, and it took a lot of convincing, but we actually did have him, finally convince him to come and have a priest come, and after, you know, 50 plus years or 60 plus years, had like a sort of an emergency general confession and received the sacraments.
Janet, let me jump in because the break's going to cut us off. Obviously, the church would never say that a spouse has to stay in a marriage that is dangerous or very threatening, seriously pathological. They would say that they could be separation of bed and board. So that's one thing. The church would never say that your mother, who was in this nasty, perhaps physically abusive marriage, would have to say, no, I gotta persevere. No, they would say you have to make the decisions for your safety and the child's safety. Now, that said, I think the bigger question for you is, you're 51. What have you done to say, I'm an adult And whatever it was that I experienced back when does not have to continue to influence the way I think and behave now.
I clearly haven't worked on that.
You feel trapped in the sense that that happened then, so therefore it's automatic, like a reflex, A equals B, that I am the way that I am. I treat my husband the way I treat my husband. I have the insecurities that I have, whatever anxieties I struggle with. All of those are rooted 40-plus years ago. It's not just what happened to Janet, and I extrapolate that out to bad childhoods. It isn't only what happened bad. It's also what didn't happen. So you remember the harshness, you remember the chaos and turbulence. But there was a lack of love, lack of consistency, a lack of security, a lack of good discipline. There was a lack of training, lack of guidance. So the lack of the kind of stuff that you need to navigate life well was also a contributing component. We tend to, and this is partly pushed by the experts, we tend to look and say, yeah, there was pathology there, so therefore it was the pathology that caused these adult struggles. Partly true. It's not the whole picture. When you have an alcoholic parent, you also have a parent who's not reliable. You have a parent you can't count on. You have a parent who doesn't teach. You have a parent who has perhaps erratic discipline. You have a parent who doesn't listen and share your deepest concerns. You have a parent who's stuck up in his own or her own struggles with addiction or alcohol. So all that's missing. Now, I think that's a contributing factor. Now, why do I say this? Well, because if you think that the pathology automatically makes you unable to navigate life well 20, 30, 40 years later, in Janet's case, that is much harder to overcome, in your own mind anyway, than the fact that I didn't get guidance or I didn't get good discipline. Those things can be more easily self-taught, if you will, than pathological damage. So that's the first thing I'm going to say about that. For the longest time, the dominant theories of personality in psychology and psychiatry focused on childhood experiences and how they can dramatically and for the worse affect adult adjustment. Freud was big on that. He was kind of the granddaddy with all that. But other theorists came along and said, oh yeah, if you had this when you were a child, this is what you're going to have as an adult. And that was dominant stuff. In the last, I say 20, 30 years, there's been more of a movement toward what they call resiliency research. Why is it that some people can be in the most horrific of situations as children, as young adults, and yet go on to become extremely well-adjusted, perhaps very, very religious, and not even indicating too much of a whiff of their former long-ago experiences? Why is this? What is it that some people are just so incredibly resilient? You know, this part of it goes back to some of the Holocaust survivors. I mean, they just were just in indescribable situations. But many of them went on to live stable lives. How? And so the resiliency research taps into all of this. Part of it's temperament. Some people are wired in certain ways that are helpful to floating through some of this ugliness. They are. They're just wired different. Those of you who have a bunch of kids, you know this. You can see it in some of your kids now. They just seem to move through life kind of with an ease or with a comfort or with a self-confidence that maybe one of your other kids doesn't have. One of your other kids is just much, much more vulnerable to bad things that happen, and they reverberate, whereas this other kid just seems to either shrug it off or adjust to it the way he's wired. Another thing in resiliency research, and I don't think that Janet had this, but they pointed out that in turbulent homes, or if you want to use the word home, turbulent situations, one stable adult, be it a neighbor, an uncle, a coach, a friend and a friend's parent when you get a little older, like 16. Someone that gives that kid support, love, stability, someone can have an outsized effect on their future adjustment. Now, Janet didn't speak of anything like that, and she's looking back on it, and she does have insight, because she said, I do all these things that I don't like to do, and she's aware of them. Okay, that's the first big step. She is aware. I'm doing these things, and if Janet were in my office, I would say, Janet, how much do you feel you are automatically tied to having to be this way? That there's no way around it. You're stuck. That's one thing I'd explore with her. Another thing I would explore with her is, in these things that you see that you would like to change, what is keeping you from changing them? I can't flip a switch and change them. No, you can't, Janet. Of course not. But you're shifting directions. Up to this point, you've said, I'm stuck. I was shaped by 40 years ago, and I'm just stuck. I'm ossified. I'm like petrified wood. No, you are aware of things that you don't like what you do, so what's keeping you from changing that? Maybe she thinks it's not in her power. Maybe she thinks those things were so impactful for so long that she can't do anything about it. I had a priest friend who once said to me, when you despair like that, you're basically saying the Holy Spirit can't give you help. The Holy Spirit cannot do anything about it because, well, you know, he just didn't get you when you were 11 years old to start shaping you. He said the Holy Spirit can work with you at any time, but you gotta cooperate. It's not a magic. The Holy Spirit's not magic. But at the same time, maybe the influence of the Holy Spirit is to make you look at yourself and say, you know, I see what I do. I don't like it. And maybe my first step is to apologize to the people I do it to whenever I do it. And speaking of apologizing, Andrew isn't yelling at me, but I am way past break.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
I was raised a Catholic and went to church every Sunday faithfully. I met a boy and he was non-Catholic, so I left the church to be with him. When I was away from church, I yearned to be home. What brought me back was my longing for the Eucharist. The Eucharist fills me with a spirit that you can't find anywhere else. I have a peace when I walk through the doors of the Catholic Church, like that's where I belong.
We invite you to take another look at the Catholic Church. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
This is Cy Kellett. Join me for Catholic Answers Live. It's 2 hours dedicated to Catholic apologetics and evangelization. Designed for Catholics and non-Catholics alike, it's your opportunity to hear from and talk with some of the leading apologists and theologians in the church today. You've got questions? we've got Catholic Answers. Catholic Answers Live, weekdays, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
I suppose if I could say one thing regarding changing oneself. Well, not one thing. I mean, it's not maybe not even the most important thing, but I think it's an impactful thing, which is we are not bound by what was. Much of psychology says we are, but that's not true. And the Christian should be the one that least thinks that. So, okie doke, I'm looking at the clock here, and so we 10 now, okay, it is coming up fast, all right, well, thank you. Walk with God, thank you for joining me.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.